You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to discuss our April 2026 book club pick, The Elsewhere Express by Samantha Soto Yambao, which was a patron's choice book club pick. As always, if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, you can head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can access to our members-only Discord server. And if you join us at the Honey Bubble level, you too can have the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick to read for book club, as well as access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats. As always, thanks to everyone who supported us through Patreon so far, and thank you for helping us pick this month's book club pick.
Yeah, but it is May. Happy Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, everyone.
Yeah. Man, I felt like it really snuck up on us. It's, I have babies at home, so I can't really go out and do stuff, but I am glad to see there's still a lot going on in our community. Because I think given the times as they are, it's more important now than ever to make sure that we make our voices heard, especially during this one month where we are, I guess, commercially viable in.
Yeah, commercially in the world, viable, right? is a great way to put it. Also, like, the reason why May snuck up on a lot of us is because every weekend something seems to happen in our government and it ages us by like a year. So it really feels like time hasn't moved at all, but also we're all like 20 years older. So we're just all very tired.
Well, at least we still have this book club to kind of tell time for us. I think this is how it's kind of become for me, is that this book club, reading a book a month and discussing it, has become my way of,
telling time.
Yeah, observing the passage of time, right?
Yeah.
But I'm glad to be getting into this book with you. As always, in our book discussion episodes, we will be discussing our book club pick in its entirety, including all character and plot related twists and revelations. And this book is at its core kind of a mystery, as well as a whimsical journey through a magical train. So if you have not finished the book and do care about being spoiled about those things, this is your cue to hit pause on the podcast, finish the book, and come back and listen to our discussion. But with that said, Rira, anything you want to go over before we get started?
Yeah, so a slight trigger warning, mentions of suicide and also parental neglect. Are there any other trigger warnings that I have to give out, Marvin?
I mean, we can talk about the actual trigger warning from the book itself and whether or not it was adequate for the book itself.
Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, as always, we'll start with the book jacket description. You can't buy a ticket for the Elsewhere Express. Appearing only to those whose lives are adrift, it's a magical train seeming to carry very rare and special cargo. A sense of purpose, peace, and belonging. Raya is one of those lost souls. She had dreamed of becoming a songwriter, but when her brother died, she gave up on her dream and started living his instead. One day on the subway, as her thoughts wander, she swept off to the Elsewhere Express. There she meets Q, an intriguing artist who, like her, has lost his place in the world. Together, they find a train full of wonders, from a boarding car that's also a meadow, to a dining car where passengers can picnic on lily pads, to a bar where jellyfish and whales swim through pink clouds. Over the course of their long, strange night on the train, they also discover that it harbors secrets and danger. A mysterious stranger has stowed away and brought with him a dark, malignant magic that threatens to destroy the train. But investigating the stowaway's identity, Raya also finds herself drawing closer to the ultimate question. What is her life's true purpose, and is it a destination the Elsewhere Express can take her to? Okay, so before we start our discussion, I just want to mention that I just want to talk about the book packaging of the physical copy of this book, because it is freaking gorgeous. It has sprayed edges of like luggage. And if you take off the dust cover, I'm just doing it in front of Marvin, like you have,
wow,
both sides have a picture of Raya in the Elsewhere Express and also the subway. And then inside there are coloring pages. So it is a very highly designed book. And I usually buy ebook copies before buying physical copies because I just like to know if a book is worth putting in my physical library, because there's only so much space. But for this book, I was like, it's so pretty. I can't not buy it. So I bought it.
Yeah, the presentation looks gorgeous. I'm kind of sad I didn't get the physical copy. By the time I realized it was like a special edition type of packaging, I'd already purchased the ebook. So, oh well. So Alice, but I'm glad you got it. I know you picked it up while you were at the bookstore was it Lisa Lee's event?
Yeah. I went for her talk for American Han, and I was just like, while I have this book, let me just wander around the store. This is the dangerous thing about going to a bookstore. You end up buying more than one book. You always bring extra cargo with you home.
Yeah, I know one of our book club members, Thomas, also picked up a physical copy and was showing off the painted edges on the Discord as well. So I was like, man, that does look pretty. I am also woefully, like, I am out of shelf space. I don't know if you can see Rira, but like, I have books stacked up on top of all my surfaces here in my office right now.
You just need floating shelves, Marvin.
That's true. That would be a solution. Yes. Let's get into the book. I guess we should start off the way the book starts off. And this is also the thing that our book club member Cup of Jen also pointed out right at the top of our discussion, which is like, do we think that the author's note at the beginning of the book was adequate as a trigger warning, and whether or not that was like the author's intention?
I have the author's note right here. So the author's note at the beginning of the book says, "This is a work of fiction that touches on the subject of gradual loss of sight. Reader discretion is advised." And I'm really surprised that that was the only trigger warning.
Especially as we go through, like, when it becomes abundantly clear that Q was going, like, he was going to attempt suicide, right, on that train platform at the beginning of his chapter. And that's not really apparent until a couple chapters in. But then, like, to me, I was like, shouldn't that be, like, if you're going to do a trigger warning, you should probably do, like, all the triggers in your book, right? So I wonder if that is like, is loss of sight supposed to be like an umbrella term for a loss of like purpose and things like that? Like,
I guess like loss of purpose. Also just, you know, like it's really sad whenever when your body can't do, like your body doesn't allow you to do the things that you are talented and skilled at, like you've worked so hard at it. Like, of course there's like a grieving process to that, but on top of like not mentioning the suicide and suicidal tendencies, I was surprised that there was no trigger warning for also Raya's situation, which is that she's a savior baby, she is a donor baby,
a sister keeper situation, right?
Yeah. So a donor baby is pretty much a child who is conceived to provide like a stem cell or a bone marrow in Hiraya's case, so that they can save their older sibling who is affected by cancer or some kind of fatal disease.
Yeah, literally like the heir and a spare in its most like literal form, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like bioethical concerns about it. I think it's kind of messed up for parents to decide to have a child just to save their other child. Because even if they say like, oh, we don't have favorites, I'm like, no, clearly you have a favorite. You're using your other child for their body. It's like, never let me go, but you're also forced to be in this family. Like, it's a really complicated dynamic.
Add on top of that the fact that it's an Asian family, so you kind of have those dynamics as well, and just it gets real messy, right? And so, yeah, I see the trigger warning as more of like a heads up on the themes of the book. I think it does feel like she's trying to like tee up the reader, but at the same time, like, I feel like then you just you have to do the trigger warning, right? Like, if it's meant to be more of like a thematic, like, here is the frame of mind I want you to be in, like, just do a forward or do like a, you know, a blurb at the top, right?
I mean, at the same time, like, it doesn't say trigger warning in the beginning of the book. It says author's note. So technically, I mean, it's very like loose in its definition. I can understand not wanting your readers to, you know, like, you want some details about the characters to be a surprise. And
yeah,
you don't want to spoil that. So I totally understand.
Yeah, I think I'm just saying, like, using the words "reader's discretion is advised" is that's the language of a trigger warning, so that people, like, you know, you're going to surprise people with your themes regardless. But then, like, if someone's going in not expecting certain triggers and then getting it, I feel like, I don't know, just like, overall didn't affect the way that I enjoyed the book, because, like, you know, not that I don't mind the trigger warnings, but I haven't had a trigger warning prevent me from like plowing through a book regardless. But like, for people who it does matter, like, I wonder how they felt when they got to those parts, right?
I can tell you how I felt as someone who is a suicide survivor. You know, a heads up is always appreciated. Yeah, especially considering that it was on a train. Like, it was, like, train related. I was like, okay, would have been nice to have a heads up about that. But, you know, I just like took a break and I was, you know, I was fine, but I would have been able to prepare myself before getting into the book. I would not have needed that break. But yeah, everybody's different. So,
yeah, that being said, I did really enjoy this book overall. Couple kind of quibbles with just the construction of the third act when all the threads starts colliding, and we'll get to that later on, because I'm curious to hear what your thoughts about it as well. But I think
we should start from the beginning, because like, it can get really, because I feel like the third act of the book, it will really divide readers on like what their overall thoughts are on the story. And I just kind of want to go through the story itself, because I don't know if you had this problem, Marvin, but like, despite the fact that Samantha's prose is like beautiful, lyrical, very like inventive and vivid with its descriptions of like the dreamlike train cars, I did get lost a bit in the sauce. And it was kind of hard to picture some of the scenes because they were so like out there. And it did take me a while to kind of extract like what the action was in those scenes. So I think going through the story for our listeners might help, because I definitely needed that guidance.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of sauce to get through in this book. It was like almost all like 90% sauce, really.
90% sauce.
And, you know, the book was pitched, it pitches itself as like a Ghibli-like, but I don't know about you, but I didn't really get Ghibli from the story.
Okay, so the thing is, you can have Ghibli vibes, but it's like not going to be Kiki's Delivery. It's going to be The Boy and the Heron. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's a book that has extra dimensions to it. It's not going to be like just cozy vibes. In fact, I don't think this constitutes a cozy vibe at all, but okay.
I think for me, it's just like, for me, Ghibli films, and granted, I haven't seen all of them, so maybe some of the ones I haven't seen are more like this, but like, you know, Ghibli is known for like whimsical storytelling. Like, to me, a Ghibli film is an art film in animated form, because for me, like, the coolest part about Ghibli films is just how Miyazaki frames his shots and how he like, essentially, how he like, applies filmmaking techniques to animation. I think that's really cool. And there's also the whimsy to it, right? But to me, the whimsy of a Ghibli film has always been more grounded in like mythology. And the whimsy in this book in the Elsewhere Express kind of feels more, it feels almost more Western, right? It feels more like a Pixar, right? Where it's like you're taking metaphorical objects and giving them physical form, or like something like Neil Gaiman, like The Sandman or American Gods, right? Like I get more of those vibes from this than like a Ghibli, right? It feels more Western, and it's like yeah, Alice in Wonderland.
I did get Alice in Wonderland vibes, but also like there's a scene where one of the cars that they enter was like this beach and has a bunch of glowing spheres in it, and the spheres contain songs, and that kind of reminded me of Inside Out. I don't know if you've seen that movie. And there's like a whole memory bank with a bunch of spheres, and I was like, oh okay, that's what I'm picturing.
I was getting a lot of Inside Out, like the way that the songs and the metaphor and the poems are like kind of turned into like physical practical objects, right? The one part that I did get Ghibli from is like Miyazaki loves animating a good bug, like insects, and there's definitely a lot of good insects.
Spiders and the dragonflies. I thought it was really clever to have like a bridge made of web, and the web is made of like stubborn thoughts.
Yeah.
And you also have the kitchen where they have grudges being boiled into literal sauce because they are spicy. And I was just like, okay, these are very clever ways of depicting thoughts and how they would be used productively.
Yeah.
And I would like to give credit to Samantha on that. There were a lot of times where I was like, oh, this is really clever. I can totally picture this. But because they're in a train and it just seems kind of like Doctor Who, where there is like, it's bigger on the inside. It was very hard to depict like where the train ends. And it could have, it doesn't even have to be a train at this point. It could just be like a house with multiple doors, you know?
I mean, the train is definitely a TARDIS within the TARDIS, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, the train is a metaphor because, you know, this train like doesn't have stops, essentially. It just goes around in a loop. It's kind of like Snowpiercer in a way.
I did. Snowpiercer was the back of my mind because I was like, there's something up about this train. There's something sinister at the core of it. And we can talk more about that later on when we discuss like the overall themes. But I don't like, I guess not to jump ahead, but like, I don't know if being on this train overall is a good thing.
Yeah, it really depends on your perspective, because the thing is, like, the whole spiel that Lily, the conductor, gives to Raya and Q at the beginning of their journey is like, oh, this is a place where people who feel lost in their lives find purpose again. And but like, in order to find that purpose, you have to discard baggage, and discarding baggage in this case is discarding memories and whatever is grieving you so that you can move on. But then in doing that, you're also losing yourself. And it's just like, well, that's not healing, though. That's literally just running away from your problems. But then for some people, it's like, well, it's a refuge. So it really depends on how you, it depends on your life's perspective. Like, it depends on what you've been through in life, because it could sound like a magical place, but it's also like,
I think for me, and sorry for jumping ahead again, I think for me, as someone who had Snowpiercer and Bong Joon-ho at the back of my mind, I was like, you know who would love a workers who don't have any memories and only focus on the task at hand? Amazon. Right.
Corporations, yes. Also kind of reminded me of Galaxy 999, if you've ever watched Galaxy Express 999, which is an animated movie that came out in like, what, I would say like the 80s. It's a very old animated film, and it's about like a train that like goes into space, and spoiler alert, the planet that the protagonist goes to, like everybody is turned into like a spare part to keep that planet running. And they're like, you would make a nice bolt because you're strong and stubborn, and you will bring stability to us. So it's kind of like that. I mean, we're jumping ahead. But there is something sinister about this train, despite its dreamlike presence. And we'll get more into that. I just kind of want to like go through the story, like I said, because it can get very confusing with like all the metaphors. So we begin with the background to Haraya and why she was named Haraya, because it means, actually, let me see what it actually means. It says, Haraya, an ancient Tagalog word commonly translated as imagination, in actual meaning was more complex. Haraya was the power of the mind to bring that which did not exist into being. So, AKA, a very desperate wish. And I'm like, what a name to give to your donor child.
Yeah, I mean, what I really appreciate about this first chapter, you know, about like the book, the way that Samantha writes is you get a lot of these asides, right? You pull back and you kind of learn about the histories, you learn about circumstances. And in this first chapter, we learn essentially all we need to know to like know why someone like Ryan would end up in a place like the Elsewhere Express.
Yeah, and I think it's important to just... like, even when we think donor child and we think of, like, their older sibling's death, we think it's, like, medical related, right? But Jace actually survived his childhood disease after a bone marrow donation from Haraya. And he dies when Haraya is 15. So this book takes place 10 years after. So she is, like, around 25 years old.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to keep that in context. It's not just like, oh, like I gave him a spare part and he died because of a procedure. It's like, no, like he was supposed to live and he was going to college. He was going to become a doctor. He was the golden boy. And then a freak accident kills him. So it's the unexpectedness that like causes a lot of trauma for Haraya.
And also just the fact that her identity is so mixed up with her role as like her brother's savior, the fact that she ends up kind of picking up his dreams and living his life while giving up her own. I think that's like, it's a really like, it's messy, but also like really believable, right? Especially with the small glimpse we have of her parents. And her parents don't really like, they don't appear in this book really at all, besides like the first few pages, but their presence is felt every time Haraya thinks about what she thinks her purpose is in life.
Yeah, there's a lot of guilt attached to Haraya, and she abandons her name. She drops the first syllable of her name. She goes by Raya for the rest of the book. And you also have a character who adopts a new name. So we have Quentin Chen Phillips Jr. I had to write that down because I totally forgot what his real name was. But
Q.
He goes by Q because Q as in like the letter Q. Because his father, who is an artist, he dies by suicide by stepping in front of a moving train. And he chose this nickname because he didn't want his mother to, you know, think of his father when she would call his name. So we have two main characters who have chosen new names, new identities to spare themselves from guilt or from other people's guilt.
Yeah. And Q's predicament is, like Raya, he's lost his purpose in life. But for him, it's because he has a degenerative disease that is essentially causing him to go blind. And as a visual artist, that's like the death of his craft, right?
Yeah, he's specifically, his medium is painting portraits, and he usually paints people not just like photographs, but like portraits are very intimate. And you get, as an artist, you get to see a lot of what they're carrying in like their posture, in like what's in their eyes. So like you feel very naked when you're in like a portrait session, and it takes not just like a good artist eye, but just, you know, you have to be able to pay attention to things. And you can just imagine how not having your sight anymore would, you know, impact your skills in that way. And he describes his vision as like, okay, have you looked through a keyhole? Like, now have that. And then now have it, like, halve it again. And that's pretty much what I can see. So he can only see, like, a pinprick of vision. So his vision is, like, pretty much gone at this point. But at the beginning of the book, he is, he has, like, his last show. And he has not finished his last portrait. And this portrait is of a woman that he has never met in real life. It's this mysterious woman that he has seen in his dreams, but, you know, he can't really figure out her face. And, you know, like, he is on his way to the gallery for his last show. And he's like, well, I have to bring this last portrait with me because people are going to be like, oh, like, the last unfinished work of this tragic artist. My agent really wants it so that they can sell it for a lot of money. And it's just sad. And he throws the portrait onto the train tracks. And that's when he gets swept into the Elsewhere Express. However, he is not supposed to be on the Elsewhere Express. Like, he is an unexpected passenger because apparently this train only takes one passenger a night.
Yeah. But he still has a ticket. So, I mean, we learn throughout the book that the train's rules, while rigid, are also fungible, right? Like, it's a dream train and there are conductors enforcing the rules. But the train itself also doesn't really follow the rules neither, right? So who's to say whether or not he was supposed to be there or not? But he ends up there. And, you know, the dream train being as it is a place for wayward souls, like, maybe he was supposed to be there. I don't know. Like, here's the thing about this book, about the Elsewhere Express, is like, Samantha Soltianbao, there's so much detail, so much visual, so much goes into describing each car and what our characters see and feel and how everything works. But I'm less clear on, like, the actual connection between the train itself and the real world and how that all works.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, like, the way you get onto the train, it's very, like, metaphorical, right? Lily, the conductor, says, "You boarded it at the end of all your dreams at a quarter past your heaviest sigh. The train caught you when you floated away." And as a reader, I'm like, that sounds cool, but what the hell does that mean? like, is your body still on the train and it's just like your soul that gets like whisked away? Like, is this like Narnia where like you're going through a tunnel and you're like in a totally different train, like, car now? Like, it's just like kind of like, okay, I don't know how we got here, but let's just consider it as like an Alice in Wonderland situation where dreams kind of just don't make sense and you roll with it.
Yeah, I mean, that passage is very Alice in Wonderland-y, like word salad, but sounds very whimsical and compelling. I thought I had a handle on how it worked until the last, like, again, we don't want to jump ahead to the final act because I think the revelations at the end of this book creates a lot of questions about what's actually happening, right?
Yeah. So anyway, Raya is on the Elsewhere Express. She meets Lily, the conductor. She tells her like how she got here, and they find Q, who's the second passenger. They like, it's unexpected. Q finds that he can see on this train, so he's no longer living in this dark world, and he's like, oh my gosh, I want to stay here because I want to keep my vision. Meanwhile, Raya is like, I need to go back home. I'm a med student. I need to become a doctor because that's what my dead brother was supposed to be, and I can't, you know, I can't disappoint my parents and all of that. So you have two characters who have opposite goals. And Lily, the conductor, says, okay, this train has a strict baggage policy. You cannot have excess baggage. And by baggage, they mean like memories, thoughts, feelings. I don't know. Just a lot of like internal.
Yeah. Like
stuff.
Like connections to your past life, essentially, right? Like,
yeah, tethers. You can't carry both your past and future, essentially. Like, in order to live on the train, you have to kind of forget what you were before.
And this is where they introduced the concept of echoes, which I believe are people who could not cast off their baggage and became, like, essentially, like, dream zombies, right? Like, lost dream zombies off the train.
Yeah, so they're introduced as what's going to happen if you don't find your compartment by the time your ticket disappears, because the ticket... it originally shows up as like paper, but then it gets like it becomes like a
tattoo.
I don't know, like a tattoo on your wrist, and it's like a clock. So you have to find your compartment before time runs out. So there's like this urgency added to the whole story. And the echoes are introduced as people who could not get rid of their excess baggage, refused to, and they stayed on the train instead of getting off in the real world.
Yeah,
and they become echoes.
I will say I expected the echoes to play a much larger role in the climax of this book. They're kind of just there as like the consequence of not finding your compartment, but kind of, I don't know, I feel like I expected them to be much more of a danger than what they actually turn out to be.
Yeah. So like, I was picturing this train to be like running on top of an ocean, kind of like in Spirited Away, you know, because the echoes are in the ocean. They're in like the
like
waves.
A metaphorical like collective unconsciousness or something, right?
Yeah. And like the reason why there's like this beach is because you have the Song Orb beach. So I'm like, okay, there's like nearby water. But again, it's like very difficult to grasp the train aspect of it, because space is like just, it's so vast.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lily, the conductor, she offers this serum, and this serum is kind of like a forgetful potion. It's like, okay, this is how you lose your excess baggage. You just have to drink this. Q and Raya, they're like, we're not drinking that yet. Q is like, I'm totally going to drink that, but not now. I feel like it's impolite to do it in front of Raya.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so because again, their characters are fundamentally different, right? Like, Q wants to forget about his baggage. He wants to forget about his responsibility. Like, and like the for him, his baggage is his dad, who has kind of become like a, what's the word, like a harbinger of his future, right? He sees his dad as like the path that's laid before him, and he would love to get rid of that. Whereas Raya is clinging on. She's literally clinging on to her baggage that she brought onto the train because it is what's left of Jace, right? And you know, because of the way that she was raised as like Jace's backup, his dreams and his goals are more important to her than her own. And that's why she like desperately wants to hang on to it.
I thought it was clever that Samantha like not only put, you know, like medical textbooks into Raya's bag, but also like her old lyrics notebook. Like, she hasn't written any new lyrics in like the 10 years that she, you know, has been grieving her brother, but she still carries around this, you know, reminder of her dead dreams. And I'm like, oh, she really doesn't have to carry that with her everywhere, but she does, and it becomes a metaphor for her guilt.
I mean, part of it is probably also that like her brother was super supportive of her dreams. And and at least the way that I read it, to like to throw that away would also be throwing away her brother's dreams for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally get where you're coming from. Yeah.
This is where we run into the rainstorm, right?
Yes. Yeah. So during their orientation, where Lily is showing them, hey, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't get rid of your ex's baggage. They notice that it's raining, and it never rains on the Elsewhere Express. So this is like the first sign of, well, I guess it's not the first sign. The first sign is like Q, a second passenger, made it to this train. But this is the second sign where it's like, okay, things are not going well for some reason. This is not the perfect utopian train that they're pitching things to be.
Also, the fact that everyone on this train repeats "It never rains on Elsa Express," it was giving like Avatar: The Last Airbender, like in the
yeah. There's no war in Ba Sing Se. Yeah, I was totally thinking of that too. Which is funny, Marvin, since you have not watched Avatar: The Last Airbender.
So. I have gained cultural awareness of the memes.
Cultural awareness, yes, through the memes. But anyway, they have to find their compartment, and you know they have to do it on their own. So the conductor leaves them for a bit, and they are pretty much going through all of these interconnected cars that are built from, you know, different emotions and thoughts, like we talked about, like the dragonfly cart, where there's like a bridge made of webs, made of stubborn thoughts. And then you have like the dining cart with the lily pad tables. And actually, like, my favorite car, I would say, was like the gallery, the archive, where you have a coin and you throw your secret in there and you get gossip or someone else's secret in exchange. And then you have a space in the gallery where it showcases one of the passengers' deepest secrets. And I'm like, no wonder people don't come here, because why would you want to? Because the risk is you're going to see your own deepest secrets in the exhibit, which is exactly what happens. It turns out to be Raya's special shame exhibit.
I was just thinking, like reading this part, I was thinking, man, they have a whole car dedicated to Facebook stalking, essentially.
I guess I did skip a car. It's like one of the first cars they encounter, and it's the beach where are in the spheres.
They're at the beach, or I think they start off in the sky, right? Because of the rain, because they encounter the rain, they have to go backwards because they can't go forward because the rain. We don't know this yet, but like the rain is very dangerous, right? It represents like some real danger on the Elsa Express. But by going backwards through the gate or through the door, which are, you know, like painting frames, right? Or like picture frames.
Yeah, picture frames.
They don't know where they're going to end up. And they end up in I think they're in the painted sky in like the painting class car. And then, mm-hmm. you know, Q is able to paint a star, which takes them down to the beach, you know, Kirby style. And that's where they meet
Dev.
Dev, right. And in the sky, they meet, was it Isla, right?
I don't remember the character's name. Yeah. This is the worst question you can ask me. I always have to write down character names.
Well, she's important because we learn who she actually is later on as well. They meet Dev, who's part of the maintenance department, right? Because that's the whole thing. Like, you're supposed to find your compartment in the Elsa Express, as well as find your department where you'll be working from now on. Because everyone on the Elsa Express, their purpose is to keep the Elsa Express running, either as like maintenance staff or as like service staff, right? And so the maintenance department keeps does repairs around the train, and their tool of choice is songs.
Poems.
Are butterflies made from songs and poems, right?
Yeah. You know, which I thought was like a pretty good, you know, metaphor for like the arts, music being a balm to a grieving soul.
Yeah.
And yeah, they can fix things that are broken that other things can't. So I was like, oh, okay, this is like a very beautiful, clever way to use music in your book. You know, Raya is able to, because she is a musician, even though she hasn't made music in so long, she still has like a musician's ear. She's able to pick the right song to heal Q's injury because he like fell while he was.
Yeah. I mean, these two chapters are there to kind of show us each, like the both of our characters are really good at what they do. Like Q's really good at painting. Raya's really good at songs. And we learn that it's both a good and bad thing, right? For Q, like he's able to essentially create anything he wants on this train, which also scares himself, right? Because he knows he has the darkness in him, right? He does have dark thoughts, like he does have those intrusive thoughts, and like he is kind of afraid of what he might do if given the opportunity.
Yeah, there's definitely like deep-seated anger inside Q, whereas there's like deep-seated sorrow and guilt inside Raya.
Yeah. So then they make it to the dining car, and this is when Lily and Rasmus, the former conductor, her mentor, like kind of essentially deputize Raya and Q into helping them deal with the what they call the stowaway, which is the dark entity that is creating the rain on the Elsewhere Express and brings rot to the metaphors that keep it running.
Yeah, yeah. And they've had a stowaway. Is this when they say, like, they've had a stowaway before, or is that revealed later? But they've had to get rid of cars in the past because this rot has spread. And they enlist the help of, well, not enlist the help, they kind of force Raya and Q to help them, which kind of sucks because they have to find their compartments before their timer runs out. And it's like, you're making them do extra work.
Yeah, but they also key on that is because they don't have a role on the train yet, they're the most expendable as well.
Yeah. And I love how Raya clocks that immediately. She's just like, I know how it feels to be used as like an expendable spare. This is what you're doing to us.
Yeah.
But yeah, they before they can actually do any assistance, provide any assistance, they have to go to the archive to get a map. And the map is a magical map, of course.
Yeah, it's a metaphorical map because this is a train of metaphors.
It's a magical map and it requires two people. So originally Q is like, well, Raya can go look for her compartment because her timer is running quicker than mine because she has a lot of baggage that she's not willing to let go of. And it turns out she can't do that because they need two people to carry the map. And it imprints itself into both of them. And I had a very hard time picturing how the map works because Raya is able to see where things are by hearing music from the doors. And of course, like, reading about music in prose form is very difficult for a visual person. So I was like, okay, how is Q figuring out his way around? Is he just completely relying on Raya to read the map?
I think he's there for, like, to carry the load, right? Because essentially they're tethered together. And if they need two people or else it'll crush the one person. So he's there for muscle, but Raya is the one with the ability to, like, to me in my head when I was picturing the scene, it was like synesthesia, right? She's probably seeing the music and kind of figuring out where things are. But yeah, I want to say because she's more innately attuned to the way the map works, she's probably the one that she's the GPS. She's the navigator.
She's
in this
GPS.
Ride, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The thing with this tether is it's not even just sharing this GPS ability. They can also, you know, kind of read each other's emotions and like tell if one is lying to them or And I was just like, okay. I don't know how I feel about this. I've read many emotional, magical tethers in books, and I just feel like it's a very, like, I don't know, like, trite way to get characters to bond together.
I guess, but also, like, what a juicy way to, like, connect these two characters who are lying about what they feel all the time to themselves and to other people, right?
Yeah, and it's not like... I guess for me, like, the problem that I have is, you know, they are able to tell the other is lying not by their own natural ability, but because of this special tether that they have. Like, I feel like it's more meaningful if it's like, okay, I can tell that you're lying because I can tell instinctively that you're hiding something.
I guess this is, I don't know if we want to jump ahead here as well, but, like, Ryan and Q are, like, they're not just partners in this story. They're also, like, romantic partners. Like, they're set up to be, like, you know, the OTP of, like, this story. And some of our readers didn't really feel that they earned it. But I kind of feel like this tether was kind of, like, a way to speed up that process, right?
I mean, I get it because they only have a night. Like, it's a very, like, there's an urgency to this train, which is very funny to me because this book is often pitched as, like, a cozy read, right? It's, like, whimsical, dreamy, and I'm like, I don't know. All I feel is dread because there's a time crunch.
Yeah, I'm not, I definitely don't get the cozy. Like, again, like, much like the Ghibli allegations, like, I don't know if, like, the marketing really captures what reading this, the experience of reading this book. Like, if this book was about just exploring the train and seeing all the wonderful whimsical stuff, then yeah, that's pretty cozy. But on the back end, you have like, if I don't find my compartment by the time this ticket finishes, I'm gonna become a dream zombie, and also there's a dream monster chasing us and trying to destroy the train as well, right?
Yeah. So they're in the gallery car, and because this is where they get their map.
Yeah.
Raya is dragged through one of the paintings, and it takes her to her shame exhibit, like I mentioned, and it depicts pretty much the night when Jace died, and it exposes, you know, like, why she gave up her dreams, and this is kind of when we find out that, like, oh, she gave up her dream because she thinks Jace's death is her fault, because she invited Jace to see her at a gig at a local coffee shop, and he was driving from college to go see her, and then he gets into an accident with a drunk driver.
Yeah.
And she's like, if only I didn't ask him to come. And I'm like, I understand the guilt. I understand that there's no logic to it, okay? It's like all emotions. But as like a very logical person, I was like, why?
I mean, I get, like, reading this book, I was like, oh man, this is just like, it's melodrama. It's very melodramatic.
It's melodrama,
right?
Yeah.
The irony of, like, oh, they think they dodged this bullet. Jace is alive. He doesn't need her yet. He might need her in the future, but right now he's chasing his own dreams, and he's coming back to see her chase her dreams, and he's super supportive. And this unimaginable tragedy happens that she still isn't over. It is a lot, and you can see why, like, for her, she because of the way that she's been parented, I would assume, her identity, even though she's chasing her own dream, is still locked into the fact that she exists because of him, and now he's not there anymore.
It is also at the shame exhibit that they get their first glance at the stowaway, who turns out to be Mothra. Like, it's like a human form covered in black moths, and I'm like, okay, it's Mothra.
They do. Well, it's like a moth. It's like a Mothman. And so there's a lot of, like any good mystery, there's a lot of red herrings, right? The fact that the fact that the stowaway is made of moths leads you to think that it's somehow linked to Q, because throughout the book, in his background chapters, we know that as an art student, he would graffiti moths everywhere, right? That was his, like, MO.
Yeah. And it was, like, during a time when he was angry about everything. So it's, like, a metaphor for his, like, teen angst and anger. And so it's like, oh, even though he buried it deep inside him, it's still there. The darkness
is
still,
like,
there.
At this point, we're thinking, is Q, like, the Q to bring this through? Is the stowaway Q's darkness? Because we do know that Q has, like, dark thoughts in him, right?
And thoughts manifest into, you know, magical things on this train, which is why it's important to discard cargo.
Yeah.
And
this is when they end up anyway, in the room of lost things, right? Like the
Yes. So stowaway comes and they have to run away. They get thrown into the mist and misplaced department, MMD. It's called MMD. And it is a locked car. And there's another rule on the Elsewhere Express. You can never go through a locked door. So they're pretty much trapped in this car. And it has, like, lost objects raining from the sky. And I mean, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
And it's here where Raya finds her old guitar that she destroyed on the night of Jace's death, but it's, like, in perfect condition. And that's because that's how she thinks of her guitar. It's always gonna be in that perfect form.
I didn't realize at the time, but this was Chekhov's guitar, right?
Chekhov's guitar. Yes. But it's in this room they meet
Ollie.
But like, it's not Ollie because Ollie's actually stirring.
He was the cook on the dining car that is like kind of, he like kind of lost his mind after becoming lost on the train for.
He became Hodor if you watch Game of Thrones.
Because he was lost in the MMD for like hundreds of years, right? Like the equivalent of hundreds of years. But we find his like the remnants of his consciousness, or like a, how would you describe MMD Ollie? Just like, kind of a ghost, right? Like a ghost.
He's kind of an echo. He's kind of an echo that hasn't been thrown off the train.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he has like the personality of Ollie pre-Holdoring, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of where I got like Inside Out vibes, along with like the spheres, because I'm like, oh, this is where like the imaginary best friends are thrown in.
Yeah, the pit of lost dreams or whatever.
Yeah, the pit of lost. Yeah. But this is where they find out that echoes are not actually people who decided to not throw away their baggage and became dream zombies. It's actually echoes are actually discarded memories. They are the cargo that people decide to throw out. And that makes them go, huh, that's not what the conductor said. So the conductor is sus. And this lie is pretty much made to pretty much scare passengers into drinking the forgetful potion. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. I think, because I had Snowpiercer in the back of my mind, I always thought the conductors were the sus. And they were definitely like, you know, throughout the book, we find that they were also hiding things even from themselves, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think like, how did they get out of the locked car? I remember Raya, like she managed to write a new song and it like repairs like the glass, the crystal tiny train that they had.
Right. The teleporting train that, Rasmus.
I don't
them.
Know how the train works. I'm like, do they shrink to fit into the train, or is it like a freaking totem that like teleports them?
I think it's best not to think too hard about it. Just like everything's a TARDIS. So it's probably
everything is a TARDIS. Okay.
Right.
I mean, there's like a very small moment that turns out to be very significant in the third act. So I'll like mention it. They're on this barge and the guy who's running the barge is like, hey, you want this scarf? Like, I will take two questions from you or whatever, like, because questions are currencies in this cart. And Q manages to pay for the scarf, and then he gives it to Raya as a gift. So it's kind of like a romantic gesture, if you will. Yeah. Very small scene, kind of a throwaway scene, but it becomes like important later. So I'm mentioning it now. But yeah, the barge takes them to
the perfume cart.
A house?
Yeah, the house, the perfume hut, where they manage to acquire a perfume that unlocks memories. It undoes the forgetful potion. And this is where there is, because so the way that the book is structured is kind of like a manual, right? So every single chapter, there is like a FAQ question that is thematically linked to the chapter itself. And this is where we learn that perfumes are actually prohibited on the Elsewhere Express.
Yeah. So like Manon's house, Manon is the perfumer. Her house is behind a locked door. And like they don't realize it until she opens the door. And she's like, oh, come on in. Like time stops in my perfume shop. So you can like take a break while smelling some scents. And also, I would like to take the scent of rain off of you because it never rains on the Elsewhere Express. So yeah. This is a new scent. And it's like, that made me question the whole locked door rule, because I'm like, well, is it a locked door when someone unlocks it? Because then it's just an unlocked door. What is the definition of a locked door? Like, but then that's the whole point, right? The rules on this train is just like a smoke screen. Yeah. And
it's, yeah, the it's just conductors a way for trying to manipulate the passengers to like not step out of line.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And with the perfumer, they find out like, oh, they have passengers on the train who, you know, buy perfume so they can feel the loss that they used to have, like this absence. They need like the absence of I don't know, like it's just like they're perfectly happy and content to be on this train, but they still want like a reminder of their past to feel sad. And it's just like, and they're like, why would you do that? And then she explains it as like, why do people watch sad movies? Because they want to feel something. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's so this almost is kind of like a drug situation where
I mean, the whole thing's kind of a drug situation, right? Like the fact that you have to drink something to forget about all your worries to function. Is that just functional alcoholism? Is that just like getting blackout drunk and like forgetting the world exists? Like there is, you know, I feel like the Elsewhere Express is just like, it exists for people to avoid going to therapy, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, the whole like serum of forgetfulness, it kind of reminds me of like the Lethe River in like Greek mythology. Like it's like in the purgatory of the Greek hell. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of what the train is. It's purgatory. Like it never has a destination. You're just kind of stuck there. And to some people who, you know, want to avoid their problems forever, it's great. But it doesn't fix anything. It just gives you an illusion of a solution.
Yeah. So we skipped the part where, because in between the Q and Raya chapters, there's also Lily and Rasmus chapters where we follow their investigations on the train as well. And Rasmus, you know, we follow Rasmus as he, you know, investigates the mess that Raya made when she gets sucked into the dream exhibit. Him and Lily go fight some echoes, and he actually gets overwhelmed by the echoes, right? He becomes an all. He gets Hodor'd at the end.
Yeah.
At some point, Hodor'd. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then so coincidentally, Ryan Q picked up this perfume that will reverse the Hodoring of Rasmus by giving him all his memories back.
Yeah. Trying to think, like, what happens next? Like I said, lots of things happen. And it was really hard for me to kind of, like, follow the action through all the descriptive prose and all the dream-like descriptions. And
well, like, okay. I think we're entering we're closing in on the final act because, like,
yeah, we're getting to the third act.
The fact that Rasmus gains not only his lost memories but all the memories he ever lost on the train, this is like a deviation point from all other. Again, we later learn that we're kind of stuck in a time loop type situation. It's not a true time loop, but it's kind of like a pseudo. Like, things have happened on this train for much longer than we're led to believe in the first half of the book, and I think Rasmus, by regaining all of his memories, comes to terms with like the fact that, like, yeah, we're just repeating the same thing over and over again. So I need to do something. I think this is the key moment where like this time length diverges.
Yeah. And also, like, we're introduced like in the first and second act that some of the passengers on this train are like different versions of the same person, because the train goes around in a loop and sometimes the same person gets swept away. And I was like, okay,
it's very Jeremy Baramy if you've ever watched The Good Place.
I was just like, I don't know how this works, but we're gonna roll with it. So they're pretty much like clones of each other, but obviously they make different choices and they morph into, you know, different people. They get to rename themselves. And we've talked about renaming in the beginning of this chat.
Yeah, the way that I read it is that, like, they get pick up people at different times of their lives, I guess. And they're, like, different people than in there. So many questions. That raises its own set of questions on how this train actually works later on. But we're led to believe that Rasmus is the only person on the train with multiple versions of himself. It's later revealed that that is not the case. But I think after this section, is this when they finally get to their compartment, right?
Yes, which I was also confused about, because when they said compartment, I thought it meant like not like an actual like room on like a Hercule Poirot Murder on the Orient Express compartment. I thought it was like, oh, this is kind of like where your dreams manifest. I don't know. Like, there was the painter lady with the painting train car. There was Dev with the beach song train car. So I thought Q and Raya would get their own train cars, but
I don't think
so. Not to be the case.
Yeah, I think the painter lady was in the painting department, and that's why she was in the painting car. But she, one would assume, has her own room somewhere on the train. That's her compartment.
Yeah. They managed to get a shortcut to their compartments because they use the telephone, and the telephone teleports them to a hotel lobby where all the compartments are.
And this is where they find out. Yeah.
Go ahead.
And this is when they find out that there's only one room between two of them. So they have to choose who gets to remain on the train. And this is when they go into the whole, and this is when they go into like, no. You deserve to be here more. No, you deserve to be here more, right? Like, the Raya wants Q to stay because Q can see on this train and will be happier. And Q, I forget why he wants Raya to stay. Maybe like innately he knows that she belongs on this train more than he does, right?
Yeah. I don't know what happens next, but I will just jump to the next thing I remember. Okay, so they're in the engine room. They get to the front of the car. It's like Snowpiercer, right? They're going to finally confront the stowaway that has been terrorizing. Well, not really terrorizing, because the passengers don't know. Everything is under renovation. So it's been very, very hush-hush. But they come to the engine room, and this is where Raya sees Jace's face on the Mothman stowaway, whereas everyone else can see nothing.
Moths, yeah.
Yeah, just a swarm of moths. And Raya's like, no, my brother is still alive. Or, I know this is not my brother, but I don't want to kill him again.
Okay, yeah, I'm confused here too, because like, did this happen before or after the compartment? It doesn't really matter. Let's just like, it happens. They come to an impasse where Raya decides she wants to save the Mothman or not kill the Mothman. And Q says, no, we have to kill the Mothman to save the train. Right. And they this is where they have their like third act breakup scene, if this was a rom-com.
Yeah. But it's also just like, we are on opposite ends of, you know, what we want, but we can respect each other. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, let's take this moment on the elevator to pretend that we are friends. I mean, they're still friends, but you know what I mean. They're like not enemies yet.
This is where we get the perspective of the elevator, and the elevator is like, I want these two to kiss so bad. Like, let's make them kiss.
But they don't. And Raya lets the stowaway get away because she thinks it's her brother. And this causes, you know, friction in her relationship with Q and Rasmus. And I don't know how, but they find a hospital room underneath their compartment, because they find out that the one compartment used to be two compartments, but it got, like, one of them got turned into a hospital room. And that's why there's only one compartment. But at this hospital room, they find the first stowaway. And this is where Rasmus and Lily had kind of trapped the first Mothman.
Wasn't this where, because this, the hospital room is Jace's hospital room, right? That's why Raya was like kind of freaked out by it, right?
Yeah.
So not to jump ahead, but a lot of clues were given towards the final twist that I had not clued into yet. I don't know if you were cluing into it at this point.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, because to me it was like, okay, the Mothman is Jace's dark side and is using Raya's guilt to save itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, for like, I knew this was a red herring, but I was like, oh well, it could still happen. Was okay, maybe, it maybe like the Mothman is Q in a different timeline where he threw himself on the train. So I was like, okay, that could be
right. If he became an echo or something, right?
Yeah, if he became an echo or like. Because at this point, I didn't know how time worked. So I was like, okay, maybe it's like different alternate timelines. And I just thought like, oh, the Mothman is dead Q, who managed to cling to the train.
I mean, you were kind of close.
Kind of, but...
right.
But yeah, this is when Raya learns, or like not learns, but she accepts that Mothman is not her brother. And she should, you know, not kill him, but it's just like send him away. So she uses the funeral song that she made for Jace's real funeral in the real world. And then she uses that to, what, bind him so that
kind of like seals him up. Yeah.
But then the second Mothman shows up and kidnaps Raya. And then, I don't remember what happens.
I mean, eventually we get to the climax, the climactic showdown, where Jace decides to sacrifice himself essentially for Raya, and in, I guess, attacking the Mothman, and in the process, kind of understands, like learns what the Mothman actually is. And then
he does is like he managed to like thrust his hand into the Mothman's chest. And that's like a big deal because, you know, in the real world, Q can't rely on his sight. So he relies on his other senses. And it is through touch that he's like, oh, I can sense all the secrets that you've been holding.
Right.
And yeah, the secret is that the Mothman is not born from Q's anger and darkness. Like the moth is not actually like the black moths that Q made when he was a young boy. Yeah.
Well, we don't know that yet. It's still a secret, right? That's okay, revealed later on. But in learning, he decides, okay, I know how to solve this. And he throws himself off the train before telling Raya to remember him. Like last words to her is remember me. Right. And then
very Howl's Moving Castle. You know that scene where Sophie manages to go to the past and she's like, Howl, look for me in the future. It's that scene.
And so, you know, ostensibly the crisis is solved. The as Q falls from the train, the Mothman disappears. Right. And then is this when Q ends up back on the train platform, or is this after?
Yeah. So this is when he is back on the train platform on the night where he, you know, was going to die by suicide, but chooses not to. And he's like, oh, I can board the train and it'll take me back to the Elsewhere Express. But he knows that if he does that, the Mothman will come back and just start the whole process all over again, start the cycle all over again. So he's like, I'm going to walk away from this train, not board the Elsewhere Express and not see Raya again so that she can, you know, live in her blissful, you know, world.
Yeah. And is this when he decides to find her in his own way, or is this, I forget if there's like any like resolution on his end, but
okay. So like, yeah, the thing is, we're in the middle of the third act, so I will bring up my main criticism is we've had different POVs. So we've had Q's POV, Raya's POV, Rasmus's, and Lily's. And that's not what, like, tripped me up. The thing that tripped me up in the third act was all the time jumping. And it's like flashback. And it's like flashback or like, oh, from earlier, this is what happened with this one character. And this is what happened with the other character in the same time period. And I'm like, okay, I guess it makes sense if it was like a visual medium where it was like a TV show where you could like cut back and forth in time easily. But in like novel form, I was just like, oh, this is too much like head jumping and time jumping at the same time.
I mean, the time jumping to like what happened earlier, that didn't bother me as much as I don't know if we want to go into this now, but like, again, the tether, the connection between, Samantha does a great job fleshing out like the visuals of the train, how things work on the train, and what things like and how they manifest. The connection between the train and the real world is what tripped me up. Like, what does it mean to get on the train? What happens to your body? And you know, let's just get to that point, right? So, after Q jumps off the train, we follow Raya as she has essentially settled into life on the train. She hasn't found the department yet, but she has a compartment, so she is no longer in danger of becoming an echo, right? And eventually she comes to the realization that Dev is actively trying to court her to join the maintenance department because she is good at music and that is what they need in the department, because none of them can actually write their own songs, but Raya can. And he mentions something about like having seen her at his own orientation and shows her a picture of a Raya that she doesn't recognize wearing the scarf that she's wearing that she couldn't have had during orientation. And that's when it clicks, right? That's when she comes to realization that she does know who that person is. It's Lily. Lily is another version of herself that came on the train like centuries ago.
Yeah, I mean, she finds out through Dev, but she also finds out, like, it's confirmed because Rasmus takes Raya to, like, the passenger manifests or, like, the passenger record train.
Right.
Car. Yeah, and this is where she, like, through some magic, like, with some needle magic, she is able to see in first person what happened to Lily as the first version of Raya.
Right. And so in confronting Lily, she realizes that like they are kind of stuck in a loop because there have been multiple versions of Raya and Q. And every time a Raya comes on the train, a Q also shows up as well as the stowaway. And every single time Q sacrifices himself to save Raya. And all the Rayas have like decided to drink the forgetful potion to forget about their guilt with Q. And to kind of become different people on the train. So this is where you find out that Isla, the painting teacher, and Manon, the perfume lady, are both versions of Raya on the train.
I don't know if Manon was a Raya. I don't know. But yeah, there are multiple versions of Raya on this train. And they have all changed faces and names. And the important thing is Lily is the first Raya. And who like kickstarts all of this. So what happened after Q sacrifices himself in the first original timeline with Lily as the first Raya? Lily drinks the memory serum. She forgets about Q. But the thing is, her guilt was so big that that single dose of the serum did not work because she has guilt over Jace and Q. So her brother and her love interest. So all the residual guilt that didn't get burned away by the truth, not truth serum, the forgetful serum, it grew wings. It became the Mothman that haunts every cycle, every
To which I say,
Raya goes through.
To which I say, why not just merely drink another dose of the potion? But I guess if she doesn't know, she needed one, right?
Yeah, they didn't know.
And so in this final climax, Raya essentially convinces Lily that actually she's the problem. Like, she is the source of
the soul. It's like, oh, this is your fault. This is your fault. And then Lily's like, yeah, it is my fault. And then she passes the conductor's cap to Raya. And then
yeets herself off the train herself.
Yeets herself off the train. Removing herself as the source of the Mothman. Yeah. I'm so sorry, Samantha, that we keep calling the stowaway Mothman. But, like, that's the only way that's going to stick with me. So,
to be fair, she was Mothman the one that made the stowaway made of moth. So, like, it's not inaccurate.
The important thing about this Raya, the Raya that we have been reading and been with on this journey, she doesn't take the truth serum. Not truth serum. Keep saying
the
truth
forgetful serum.
Theorem,
yeah.
She doesn't take the forgetful potion. And also she has a memento from Q. Q had drawn a portrait of her and on the back has written, like, oh, this is you. Your name is Raya. Don't forget yourself. Don't forget me. And that's very important because, you know, this is like the first change in the cycle. She doesn't take the forgetful potion and she doesn't change her name and she doesn't change her face.
And she doesn't become an echo.
Yeah, she doesn't become an echo.
Because that was bullshit.
But she becomes a conductor for... we don't know how long. It could be 6 weeks, 6 months, 60 years, like the book tells us.
Yeah.
And she finds another version of Raya, like when she boards. And in this new Raya's bag, she finds not only the ticket for the Elsewhere Express, but she finds this invitation to an art exhibit by Q in the real world.
Yeah.
And it has the message, on the count of three, jump. And Raya is like, okay, this is like, I'm going to jump. I'm going to trust Q. And she gives the conductor's cap to Rasmus and then opens the back door, which is where Q came out from when he first boarded the train. And then she yeets herself. And then she finds herself landing
back on the subway that she was on before she entered the Elsewhere Express. So, okay. How does this work again? Like, does she...
This can't be the original body that she left from. This is the body of the Raya, that just boarded the train.
Because she's going to the exhibit. So, was this invitation already in her bag to begin with? Or is this a new development, right? And how does, like, are we in a different time? Like, I've thought really hard about this because it's one of the parts of the book that just, like, it doesn't, like, Samantha explains a lot of things about the train, but she doesn't explain very much about how the train connects to the real world. And so, like, you know, we're left to fill in the gaps. So in my mind, they're in, like, a different timeline, right? Because have you ever seen the series Dark? The German series Dark that's on Netflix. It's all about like time travel and like time loops and essentially
I have seen enough Doctor Who in my life to know.
Right.
Yeah.
So like, okay, so the way that I maybe piece together is, so Q jumps off the train, arrives back on the platform and decides to live on, right? Like, he doesn't want to go back on the train. He wants to like kind of essentially find Raya on his own terms. And he does so by becoming an experiential artist, kind of like a Kusama, right? And he creates his exhibit to one day reach Raya and, in a sense, reach her back on the train. So are we to assume that Raya and Q initially boarded the train from different time periods?
I'm guessing it's different time periods because... Right? Q has had dreams since childhood of the Elsewhere train. Like, he has seen the song spheres, he has seen the dragonfly bridge, and this is like the basis of his exhibit. He like recreates these train cars in a tangible way for his guests to experience, like two at a time. So Yeah. So I think the cue that gets thrown back, like, it's like several years before Raya even not existed, but like before she became like a med student almost, because he's dead in the timeline that Raya.
I had to read that part several times, kind of like wrap my head around what was going on here, right? So like he had died in the time between finishing this exhibit and Raya going to the exhibit. And so, yeah. It also, so another, an alternate theory is this Raya is a different Raya that entered the Elsewhere Express further down on the timeline, right? So like, but then she's still a med student, so it couldn't have been too much. I don't know. The time, like, this is the aspect that like I only get pieces of what's going on here.
Yeah. And it's also like difficult for me to like picture Q, because I was like, how old is he? Because I know how old Raya is. Raya is 25. So I'm just like, is Q like a decade older? And like, this is why like the time jumping like makes sense. But anyway, like at this exhibit, the ushers like, actually, I noticed that your name is Raya on this ticket and we've been waiting for you. And he takes her to the final room, which has been barred from the public. And this is when she finds out that Q has passed away, and his final wish in his will is for her to create music for each of the rooms that he created for his exhibit. And then we cut to...
We cut back to when Q lands back in the real world from the Elsewhere Express. So is this the same Q, or is this a different Q that threw himself off the train? We don't know, but this one runs into Raya right away. So Raya has somehow time traveled or shifted into this timeline. And at the end, they arrive at, I guess, a dream station.
Is it a dream station, or is it just the exit of the real train station?
I don't know.
Okay, so this... I'm just like, okay, maybe they're at like Grand Central Station in New York, right? And they're like, okay, it's time to go up the escalator. And then they reach like the main level where it's like the ceiling is made of glass.
So I guess it comes back to, do you think at the end of this book, do they decide to return to the train together, or do they decide to go and live their own life off the train?
I think it's live their life outside the train.
Okay.
Because the thing about the train is...
there's no life.
There's no life. And also, it's the illusion of healing. The fact that they have both, you know, overcome their traumas and are willing to live on their own terms, they are off the train, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah. So, but that is the end of the book. She's like, she says, like, this is their stop. And
so
what an anime ending.
Yeah, it's definitely like it takes the romantic exit, right? Which is like these two people that we're told are meant for each other find each other in the end. Do you think she time travels back like a decade or two to find him?
I don't know if she time travels or if Q time travels, but one of them time travels. You know, this... the whole, like, different versions of Raya and, like, time traveling reminded me of the Clamp series Tsubasa Reservoir Chronicles. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's, like, with characters from the Clamp universe. So you have, like, Cardcaptor Sakura and Shaoran and, like, other Clamp characters. But anyway, like, there are... it's so twisty, time twisty with, like, universe jumping and like doppelgangers and clones, and I was just like, okay, so it's like that where like in Reservoir Chronicles, like the clones are sent back in time to become the parents of the characters that you have been following throughout the book. So I'm like, okay, maybe it's like that where they like jump way further into the past when like Q is...
Yeah, because like I don't think we're okay, crazy like, to listen, assume like, that his, like
the exhibit that he makes, like he recreated all of the dream cars, right? He's blind at this point and he had to relearn how to make art, and it's like 3D like sculptures and stuff. So I'm like, okay, that must have taken a long ass time to not only relearn how to make art, but also to make it. So right. It's been like, so I'm guessing like it's been 20, 25 years.
Yeah. So I don't think it's out of pocket to assume that Raya showing up at his platform means that she somehow got back onto the Elsewhere Express, found his exit, and jumped off to find him. Right. Or, I mean, we don't see what happens. It's left up to our imaginations. One can only assume Samantha might not know, even know how it happens, just that it does. I'm willing to accept that ending because it is a happy ending. And it is like, I think it's a much better ending than them deciding to both get back on the train, right? Because that is like, that's not progress at all.
I don't know about this ending. I mean, it's happy, but also I'm like, it's not the same Raya that we were following. The Raya that, you know, we followed from the beginning of the book, like she's left at that exhibit and she finds out that Q is dead. And that's the character that we started with. The Raya at the very end of the book, which is almost like an epilogue, is a totally different Raya.
You think? Oh, I thought it was the same Raya. I thought she somehow
no, I don't think
got
so.
Back on the train.
No.
And then,
huh. My understanding was it was a different Raya. So I was just like, why is this the ending? The ending should have been at the exhibit because like, also, this isn't the same cue that we've been following in the book either, because the cue that we followed stepped away from the train platform and walked away. So I'm like, this is a different cue in a different timeline.
Oh, no, but like the final chapter starts the same way as the cue chapter where he lands on the platform and walks away. So the way I read it is, it's the same cue that we followed that jumped off the train, landed, and would have gone on to create our exhibit for Raya in the future. But a version of Raya caught him before he left. And now there's like another branch from this. Like, so the root cue.
Yeah, it is.
Still
it is
same,
like a different
right?
branch.
Yeah.
What was that video game where they shifted? Yeah. Virtue's Last Reward. Zero Escape Virtue's Last Reward, where they like shift into different timelines and in different bodies, and they're like, oh, but is this me? Because like I moved my consciousness from the future to my past self, so therefore I killed my past self. And I'm like, oh god, I can't think about this too hard because
It also reminds me of Steins Gate. I don't know if you've ever watched or played
Steins Gate,
where
yeah.
It's like, yeah, they're trying to solve this problem of whatever they do, the same thing keeps happening because that's what time wants to do. And so they're trying to peel back the layers to find what is the inciting incident, what is actually the source of the crisis, and in the end kind of find a way back to where they want to be. So, okay, I think I figured out a possible sequence of events that would lead to our Raya and our Q being together in the ending, which is, so we've already established that this is our Q, just a different branch from the queue that created the art exhibit. What if he became so good at art? Because we already know he's awesome at art. He became so good at like art that he's able to recreate the magic of the Elsewhere Express. And so in that special room that he brings Raya, there's actually a functioning back door that she jumps into that takes her to him on his platform.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's doable. But also, like, it made me think about how when we see art, when we hear songs, like, it is like time traveling and going into a different timeline and different universe. So I wonder if there was like a trigger, like you said, like a doorway, like yeah. maybe I don't know, a song played later. And then she's like, oh, my God, I can like skip back in time. Or there's a lot of ways you can go about this. And I think we're. You know that meme where, like, from Sherlock, where there's like all these like red strings and
like the mind
background?
Palace. There's the mind palace from Sherlock, and there's also the red string board from It's Always Sunny.
It's the red string board. Right? So we're becoming those people. We're like, yeah. this is how he did it. This is how he didn't die and came back.
Which I feel like is there's what Samantha no wanted answer. Us to do. Like when you create a the whole world based on metaphor. Like, we kind of, everything is possible, everything is permitted, right? So
but I'm tired reading this book. When I was reading this book, I was just like, maybe I just don't have the whimsy in me anymore. Maybe I'm just like not as creative as I once was, because I'm like trying to figure out the logic of it. I'm trying to like, I'm not a STEM person. So I like don't know like what possible scientific theories there are, but I'm just like, why am I trying so hard to like explain how the series of events are happening, where it's just like, it's so much easier to just say it's a dream and none of this is real. Just roll with it. And I'm like, I could roll with it for like maybe the first half of the book. And then in the second half, I was like, I'm having a real hard time.
It does lose its steam once it starts to try to connect all the dots. Once you start placing the red string on the board, that's when it starts kind of imploding in on itself. I think it's the type of book, it's the type of story you kind of have to go with the metaphor as presented, right? It's like Inside Out, like Pixar's Inside Out, right? Like, none of this is how things actually work, but you kind of get it because it's like physical manifestations of metaphor, and you kind of understand the metaphor, right? You understand music, and I think Samantha does a really good job explaining why the metaphors are presented this way physically, right? Why they're spiders, why they're butterflies, and things like that. I think all that works. Again, it's when the book starts to connect back to the real world where it kind of start losing the threads. But I think overall, the themes of like purpose, dreams, guilt, responsibility, I think those did resonate pretty well through the story, right? Like the fact that like this is a train where people find their purpose, but in doing so, they have to give up their individuality, their memories. And is that something you're willing to do, right? Are you willing to give up your memory to find purpose? I think that's a really interesting kind of question, again, because in our real world, in our, you know, late capitalist society, they kind of like, that's kind of what they want us to do. They want us to be they want us to be emotionless worker bees without any individuality, without needs, without the need to like unionize or want things, right? And is that really a way
to live? And for me, like, it poses the question, is purpose the same thing as a task? Because that's what it seems like on this train. Everybody has, like, a job, like, they are in a department, but that's not really a purpose. They're like, oh, you exist just for this task. And I'm like, okay, but that doesn't seem like a purpose. That seems like, I don't know, you're meeting shareholders, expectations. Like, it's not living for yourself or other people. You're just living for this train's existence and hoping that it doesn't fall apart. And I don't know, that's just not a life, in my opinion. So it doesn't, the whimsy is gone.
Right. And, you know, to go along with that big tech, the big tech, like, metaphor, they also have great perks, right? You get good food, you get recreation, you have great dining car. Like, there's all these things that make your stay on the train more comfortable, as long as you remember why you're there for, and you're there to keep the train running at all times. Never stop. Don't stop for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of, this book could have gone in two different directions, and I think that is like the main core issue that I have with it. It's like, you could have either made like a cozy read where it's like very healing, you know, like you take your time and you explore the cars and, you know, figure out like why it's important to still hang on to some of that baggage, but also not lose yourself completely by becoming an echo, versus the other half of the book, where it's like, there's urgency. You need to find your compartment. There is this monster that's like terrorizing the car and the existence of all of the passengers. And with those two things that are just melded together, I'm like, oh my God, it just feels like I am in turbulence. So that was like my main issue with it. I enjoyed the ride, even though I got lost in it. But I thought it was very creative.
Yeah, I also, same. I think, you know, overall, I did enjoy reading the book. I did end with a lot of questions that, you know, we worked through this conversation. Are they the correct answers we came to? Who knows? But like, I feel like, but yeah, I agree. Like, I think Samantha tried to thread the line between like a cozy adventure and like a Snowpiercer, right? Yeah.
Again, like, I kind of wish that the train aspect of the book kind of stayed more rooted in realism because of like the TARDIS metaphor where like everything, there's like so much space. And I'm like, okay, it would have been cool if it was still like, there was still some like limit to the size, but that's just me. Because this is a world where like doors are in teacups and yeah. picture frames, and space is just a theory. There is no limit. So
yeah,
but to me, I'm just like, well, it couldn't have been a train. It could have been anything else.
Could have been a cruise ship. Could have been. I think a train is a fun setting, and like it gives the opportunity to do a lot of like really interesting visual things, right? Like the fact that the connectors between the trains are like a couple in embrace was interesting to think about.
Yeah,
a little messed up, a little freaky. I mean,
the whole like using other people's daydreams and thoughts and creative powers to, you know, use as parts to make this train running. I mean, very capitalistic, in my opinion.
oh man, are you saying this train is made of AI?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think that's a great place to end the conversation. What did you think of the Elsewhere Express? Please, if you're part of our Patreon, or if you want to join Patreon, like, let us know your thoughts on our thread.
Yeah.
Because I'm really curious. This talk has been going for like 2 hours now, and I'm sure it could go on for even longer if we don't limit ourselves. But
yeah,
curious to hear everyone's thoughts and continue the conversation further.
Yeah. And I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of The Elsewhere Express by Samantha Soto Yambao. All right, before we go, for the month of May, it was my turn to pick our book club pick. And because it is Heritage Month, I thought it'd be cool to check out a classic from the canon of Asian American literature. So for the month of May 2026, we are reading No-No Boy by John Okada, which was a 1957 novel depicting the aftermath of Japanese American internment as the internees return to public life after being released from the camps, specifically following the titular No-No Boys, who answered no to the infamous government loyalty questionnaire given to internees during the camps that essentially asked internees if they're willing to serve in the United States Army and swear absolute loyalty to the United States of America. I remember reading this book for the first time in college for my Asian American literature class and really learning a lot about not only the depiction of post-camp life for Japanese Americans, but also thinking about what loyalty means to a country that has denied you and your family due process as citizens. A theme that is somehow even more relevant today than it has been for a while. And so I think it's a really great time to dive back into No-No Boy. Whether you're rereading it like myself, or if this is your first experience with the book, I'm really looking forward to the discussions we'll have on Discord as well as this podcast. Again, for those of you who are part of our Patreon, the reading schedule for our Discord discussion is posted now on the Book Pick thread. So definitely check that out. And yeah, looking forward to how this 1957 novel has aged today in 2026. And so yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again for joining us for our discussion of our April 2026 book club pick, The Elsewhere Express by Samantha Soto Yambao. We hope you enjoyed listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora.
Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former beer league player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.